Well, tonight we've gathered together to hear from our guest, Professor Richard Buggs, to answer the question very specifically, did Darwin make atheism credible? We're sure this is going to be a stimulating evening, and linked closely with our key aim here at St. Nick's Church, it may just be as a result of this evening, you'd be interested in looking into the Christian faith in a little bit more detail. And we'll be giving information about a Christianity Explored course at the end, if you're interested. Tonight is an evening of two halves. In the first half, we will hear our question addressed, and I'll be handing over shortly to Professor Richard Buggs to answer that question. The second half of the evening will be an opportunity to ask Professor Richard Buggs questions. It may be that all sorts of questions come up this evening as a result of what he has to say. And so I would encourage you to ask any question that you like. If you can find the details of our Slido question app, you should find details near the invitation that you were given to log on to the event this evening. If you find details of how to do that, then those questions will come to my attention and I will ask those questions to Richard at the end of our time in the second half. We aim to close this evening by 8:05, although because of the late start, I think we will extend that till 8:10, if you can bear with us. Let me say a few words about our speaker, Richard, before I hand over to him. Richard is the Professor of Evolutionary Genomics at Queen Mary University in London. He's a senior research leader at the Royal Botanic Gardens of Kew, where he leads research on tree health. Often he's in the media talking about his research, 50 publications that he has written in scientific journals and cited over 4,000 times by other scientists in his field. So his work is well documented. He has a doctorate from Oxford University, and Richard is a Christian who often blogs about issues to do with science and Christianity. I've known Richard for some time, and actually his wife, Hannah, taught my children music at primary school. So it's really great to have you with us this evening. Richard, come and join me. I'm going to ask you just a few questions, if that's okay. And I think we're now using this mic, so I'm going to speak into there. Just a few questions. Evolutionary genomics. What on earth? You're the professor. What does that mean?
Well, genomics is a study of whole genomes. So that's all of our DNA or all of the DNA in an organism like a tree. I mainly study trees. And so we've only been able to look at whole genomes the last 10 or 15 years or so. And evolutionary means we're looking at change over time in genomes. So in my group, that means we're comparing individuals and we're comparing species and looking at the differences in their genomes. That keeps us in a job.
Keeps you in a job. Well, describe that job in a little bit more detail. I mean, what you actually do day to day. What does a day in the life look like?
Well, my job now is mainly writing research grants, of bringing in money for my research group and writing the papers that result from the research once we've done it. And then I'm supervising the bit in the middle that's done by postdoctoral researchers and PhD students. So I'm afraid most of my time is simply sat up to my computer, tapping at the keyboard.
You interact a lot though with people in the field of biology particularly. Just sort of give us a few broad brushstrokes across that sort of landscape. I mean, are most of the biologists you deal with, are they ardent atheists like Professor Richard Dawkins?
No, they certainly don't come across as having the same kind of zeal that Dawkins have if they are atheists. And many of my colleagues, I'm sure, are not atheists at all. Biology is a more friendly place to be as a Christian than you might imagine from what you see on TV. It seems that the ardent atheists get more coverage from the media than perhaps is representative of biology as a whole.
Well, it's really wonderful. It's a treat for us to have you here this evening. Thank you very much. I'm going to hand over our question again. Did Darwin make atheism credible? Over to you.
Thanks, Chris. Well, it's a pleasure to be here and to take on this topic. Did Darwin make atheism credible? And of course, as a biologist and as an evolutionary biologist, this is something I've had to think about a great deal as a Christian, because I think most people would say, yes, Darwin did make atheism credible. I'm sure if you asked your average atheist why they're an atheist, within the first few sentences, the name Darwin would come up. And the point has been made very well, actually, by Richard Dawkins, who's just been mentioned in his book, The Blind Watchmaker, where he talks about the Darwinian mechanism of evolution. He says in chapter one that almost, sorry, I'm just trying to come up with the quote for you. I did have some slides, but unfortunately, due to the various technological glitches, I don't have my slides, so I'm just working from books. He says that basically, here's my page. Darwin made it possible to be an intellectually fulfilled atheist. Darwin made it possible to be an intellectually fulfilled atheist. Now, to understand why Richard Dawkins would be making that point, we have to think, well, what was it like before Darwin? Why was it impossible before Darwin to be an intellectually fulfilled atheist? And Dawkins points out that the reason why is because of the complexity of the world around us. Because life and the globe and the solar system and the universe just appear to be designed. We look at them and we naturally think, well, we have a purpose. This universe has a purpose. Everything around me, someone wanted us to be here. Someone gave me legs for walking. They gave me eyes for seeing. They gave me ears for hearing. And throughout history, that was seen as just such an obvious and intuitive argument for the existence of God. You know, if you pick up the Christian Bible, and of course the Old Testament is shared with Jewish people and Muslim people as well. If you look in the book of Psalms, you quite often see references to the natural world. The psalmist looks at his body and he says, I'm fearfully and wonderfully made. And he immediately ascribes that to a creator God. Or in another place, he says, I look at the heavens and they are obviously the work of your hands. And that kind of thought isn't unique at all to the Bible. It's something that is spread throughout all cultures. We look at the natural world and intuitively we think, this must have been designed. There must be a designer. And the only designer capable of creating such a complex world must be God, someone just infinitely greater and more intelligent and more powerful than us. That argument didn't really get formalized until Socrates and Plato. But the reason why it didn't get formalized until then is because before that, no one really had any counter argument against the idea, the intuitive idea, that the living world is so complex and so purposeful that it must have had a designer and a creator. But in the time of Socrates, just before Socrates, a group of Greek philosophers called the atomists were thinking about the natural world, and they were thinking about ways of explaining it without appealing to a creative superintelligence. And the atomists said, well, what if everything is made up of tiny, tiny things called atoms? And what if the universe is infinitely old and infinitely large, and all the time atoms are just coming together at random within the universe? If the universe is big enough and old enough, surely there's enough opportunities for us to be able to explain the world around us purely by chance. We just happen to be on the one planet of billions and billions and billions of planets that has been lucky enough for complex life to come together as we know it, for the atoms to come together to make living things that would reproduce. Well, what they were really saying was there's a giant cosmic lottery and we are the winners in that lottery. But of course they had various problems. For one thing, how did they know there was a lottery going on in the first place? You know, we know that it's actually very difficult to make a machine to come up with randomness. Randomness doesn't just happen easily. Scientific laws take over the movement of atoms and mean that instead of just forming anything at random, they tend to form repeatable things like spheres, for instance. And the atomists had great problems in showing how it could be that the universe was set up so that atoms could just come together in random ways which would mean that by chance we might get something as complex as the world that we see around us. And so because they were relying so heavily upon such ginormous amounts of luck, the idea of winning a lottery that they couldn't even show was happening, not many people became atheists. No one found them very persuasive. And Socrates argued against them like this. He would say, look at a statue. And of course, at the time, statues that looked realistically like human beings were the latest thing in human art and civilization. And Socrates would say, look at a statue. Don't you immediately admire the artistry, the skill, the intelligence that went into making that statue? You don't for a moment think that that statue just spontaneously appeared from a random concatenation of atoms. You immediately think, well, someone very, very skillful put that statue together. And Socrates said, well, how much more when you look at an actual human being that statue that's just made of stone is modeled on, and that human being can walk, could see and hear and smell. It's made up of lots of different tissues and components. How much more is a human a testimony to intelligent causation? Somebody must have purposed humans to be here and made them. So Socrates made this analogy between human craftsmanship, human artistry, and the living world, and said, if we know that artifacts made by human craftsmanship must have come about through an intelligence, how much more when we look at the incredibly more complex and apparently purposeful structures of the natural world? And, you know, we do find exactly the same comparison made in the teaching of Jesus Christ in Matthew chapter 6. Jesus tells his followers, consider the lilies of the field, how they grow. They neither toil nor spin. Yet I tell you, even Solomon, in all his glory, was not arrayed like one of these. So Jesus is making this comparison. He says, look, here's a flower, part of the natural world. But that is far more beautiful than Solomon the king was, in all his glory, dressed in the robes that skillful artists had made him, at the point when Israel, the kingdom that he ruled, was at its very height of sophistication and wealth and artistry. And Jesus says, look, if we compare human craftsmanship with the natural world, we can see the natural world just far excels the best of human craftsmanship. And Jesus is just taking it as read that his listeners will immediately think, well, yes, that flower, which so excels human craftsmanship, that flower must have been made by a superhuman intelligence who is God. And Jesus' main point is not therefore God exists, but therefore there's a God who exists, who cares about us, a God who is personal. And his immediate conclusion is, well, you don't need to worry about the things of this life. So Jesus is also making this comparison between human artistry and the natural world. And down throughout the centuries, this argument has for most people been one of the most obvious arguments, the most straightforward arguments for the existence of God. And this is why Richard Dawkins says, before Darwin, you just couldn't really be an intellectually fulfilled atheist. But, he says, Darwin solves the problem. Darwin solves the problem of biological complexity. Well, how does Darwin do that? How does the Darwinian mechanism solve this problem for us? And here I have a little illustration, and I've borrowed this from my three-year-old son, who no doubt is missing it right now. Imagine that my wife and I walked into our living room one morning, and our son's toy box had fallen over, and the pieces of his Brio train set were just scattered over the floor of our living room. But amidst all of the random rubble of the different pieces, there was a perfect circle. Eight pieces had all come together to make a circle. And for good measure, there was also a little train on the top. Now, my wife and I have a conversation. My wife says, look, someone has been in our living room. someone's been here, some intruder who likes playing with Brio, and they've made a train set. And I look at it and say, no. That's not what it is at all. What this is telling us is that there are just billions and billions of train sets in the world. And we happen to have the lucky train set that has been tipped over. Train sets must be being tipped over all the time. You know, these things happen. And ours is just that one lucky instance where all of these pieces have just happened to fall into a circle. We can explain it by luck and just appeal to the idea that there were many, many opportunities for this to happen. Well, my wife would think I was crazy. And she would be right. And that's where people were before Darwin. All they could appeal to for the origins of complexity, mechanisms put together out of lots of different pieces in a purposeful fashion to do something, the only explanation they had without a creative intelligence was luck. Well, how would the Darwinian mechanism solve this problem for us? Well, imagine this. Imagine that instead of having to appeal to everything just happening at once, we have a situation where, yes, the box of the train set kept on falling over. But then if two pieces happened to fall together, there was a mechanism that said, well, keep that. Keep those two together. Everything else can continue to move around at random, but keep them. Then after many more disruptions, many more throwing around of bits of the train track, eventually perhaps another piece might be added to those two, and now we've got three. And the mechanism is saying, okay, keep bits of train track that are stuck together. The longer they are, the better. And if they're circular, even better still. And so eventually, bit by bit, you know, maybe over thousands of years, but that doesn't matter, so long as they're being preserved, bit by bit, we set up this circular train track as we saw. Now, this is how the Darwinian mechanism works. Richard Dawkins argues what it does is it breaks down improbability. Very improbable to have a circle of fall once, but if we just do it step by step, each of these little steps is just slightly improbable. And if enough of them happen, which is sure to happen over time, then eventually we'll build up something complex like this. And Richard Dawkins says, look, this breaks down the massive amounts of luck that we needed before as atheists, and now we can explain away biological complexity. And he gets very enthusiastic about this, and you can't really blame him for that, because it does seem to be a ticket to atheism, and he seems pretty keen for there not to be a god. But I think he gets so excited about it that he overstates how little luck is involved in this Darwinian process. And in his book, The God Delusion, he repeatedly says this process is not a matter of luck. He repeatedly says natural selection is not a matter of chance. It's not a matter of luck. Now, he has a slight equivocation going on there, because as a scientist, I read that and think, yeah, that's true, natural selection is not a matter of luck, because within the Darwinian mechanism, you can identify just a part of that mechanism, which is natural selection, and that's the bit that says, if you've got two pieces together, keep them. That part isn't random. And so, as a biologist, when I read natural selection is not a matter of luck, I think, well, yeah, that's true. There are other parts of the Darwinian process, such as mutation, recombination, drift, which are a matter of luck. But the problem is, as often happens in the communication of science, Richard Dawkins is using the term natural selection to refer to the whole of the Darwinian process. He's not referring just to that little bit of it that, as a biologist, I might identify as the natural selection bit. He's referring to this whole process of change, random change, and selection. And that whole process does involve a great deal of luck. It involves luck in how these pieces are falling down, using our analogy of a train track. But there are other parts of it that demand luck as well, if we're going to build up something that's complicated by the Darwinian mechanism. For example, let's say I've got this circular train track. Well, natural selection is saying this is good because it's quite long, and it's circular. And let's say those are the things we've selected. What this means, though, is that I'm stuck with the circle, because to get anything more complicated from this train track, I've got to introduce some kind of junction like this. And to get that in there, I've got to go backwards. I've got to take a piece out. I've got to go from something which looked perfect to my system of natural selection to something that's broken, and then I need to add something else. And once that is there, then I can start building up something. But natural selection can't say, do this because this will open up future possibilities. It can't think ahead. It's intelligences that think ahead. Natural selection is not intelligent. That's the whole point of it. It can't think ahead like that. So the only way you can go backwards in order to then later, luckily, go forwards even more, is by chance. And it's well known within evolutionary biology that you can be at something that we call a fitness peak. This circle is a fitness peak. But then to go to an even higher fitness peak, you'll have to go to a fitness trough. That's a broken circle. And we need random processes, which we call drift, to get us across that kind of peak. That involves, of course, a lot of chance. That involves luck. So the Darwinian process does involve rather more luck than Richard Dawkins really lets on in The God Delusion. If you just read the God Delusion as a layperson, he makes it sound as if this Darwinian mechanism is just so unreliant on luck that it will just inevitably produce more complexity. And really, you would be silly not to think that biological complexity, our own selves, have not come about through the Darwinian mechanism, unaided by any intelligence. Now, I could give you many other examples of places in the Darwinian mechanism where chance and luck are needed. But I don't really need to labour the point, because Richard Dawkins himself, in The God Delusion, admits that even outside of the Darwinian process, he still needs a lot of luck to explain how we got here. He admits that the Darwinian process can't explain everything. For example, it can't explain the origin of life in the first place. The Darwinian mechanism only works if you have replicating biological organisms that can have random mutations upon which natural selection will act. Until you have things that can self-replicate, you can't have the Darwinian process. So in order to explain the origin of life, he resorts to saying, well, there was a huge amount of luck that enabled this to happen. And he now I think I've probably lost my place in this book as well. And I can't, off the top of my head, oh, here it is, page 140. I did remember. He says, the origin of life lies outside the reach of that train. By that train, he's referring to the Darwinian process. He's embedded to a powerful train. The origin of life lies outside of the reach of that train. Natural selection cannot proceed without it. But he says we can deal with the unique origin of life by postulating a very large number of planetary opportunities. Well, that's interesting. He's resorting back to the same argument as Democritus, the atomist philosopher, had in ancient Greece at the time when it wasn't intellectually fulfilling to be an atheist, according to Richard Dawkins. We can deal with the unique origin of life by postulating a very large number of planetary opportunities. Once that initial stroke of luck has been granted, natural selection takes over, and natural selection is emphatically not a matter of luck. There's one of those statements, again, which I think is quite misleading, and this book is peppered with those kind of statements about natural selection as the whole Darwinian process. He then goes on, and I was amazed when I read this for the first time. Nevertheless, it may be that the origin of life is not the only major gap in the evolutionary story that is bridged by sheer luck, anthropically justified. And when he says anthropically justified, he means invoking many, many, many planetary opportunities. So, for example, my colleague Mark Ridley, in a book called Mendel's Demon, has suggested that the origin of the eukaryotic cell, our kind of cell with a nucleus and various other complicated features such as mitochondria, which are not present in bacteria, was an even more momentous, difficult, and statistically improbable step than the origin of life. The origin of consciousness might be another major gap whose bridging was of the same order of improbability. One-off events like this might be explained by the anthropic principle along the following lines. There are billions of planets that have developed life at the level of bacteria, and only a fraction of these life forms ever make it across the gap to something like the eukaryotic cell. And of these, a yet smaller fraction managed to cross the later Rubicon to consciousness. If both of these are one-off events, we are not dealing with the ubiquitous and all-pervading process, as we are with ordinary run-of-the-mill biological adaptation. The anthropic principle states that since we are alive, eukaryotic and conscious, our planet has to be one of the intensely rare planets that has bridged all three gaps. So Richard Dawkins is having repeatedly to resort to the same arguments that Democritus had to resort to even before Darwin. He needs huge, huge, huge amounts of luck to explain how we got here. Things really haven't moved on very much at all. You can understand why he's very excited about the Darwinian process, because it does seem to be able to remove some of the need for luck. But he's still relying on massive, massive doses of luck in just the same way as Democritus did. But it's somewhat worse for Richard Dawkins than it was for Democritus back in, 400 or so BC. Because back then it was plausible to suggest that perhaps the universe was infinitely large, and perhaps it was infinitely old. But today we know that the universe isn't infinitely old. Everyone agrees it had a beginning. Everyone agrees that it's finite. It doesn't have infinite extent. And so Richard Dawkins has fewer planetary opportunities to play with than Democritus did, because Democritus was able to posit that he had an infinite number of planetary opportunities. In addition, we know so much more today about the complexity of the biological world. We know about DNA and how it's an information coding system that's far more advanced than any software that we program at the moment. We know about the incredibly complex nanomachines that drive life in our cells. We know that there are tiny turbines in all of life which allow energy to be changed from a flow of ions into molecules called ATP that allow energy to be moved around our cells. We understand now the absolutely staggering complexity of the mechanisms of life, things that someone like Democritus in 400 BC had no idea about, indeed things that Darwin himself had no idea about, and indeed things that weren't known even when Richard Dawkins wrote The Blind Watchmaker a few decades ago. Every week in scientific journals, there are published new complex structures that we didn't know about before, and each of them, we look at it, and you just intuitively think that must have been designed. Someone must have intended that to be here. And we can't even imagine a gradual evolutionary process by which these complex structures have come about. So I'd argue that argument made by Socrates, that argument from design, is actually more powerful today than it was back then in several hundred BC. And indeed, the argument that Democritus had back then is really still the same argument that Dawkins is having to return to defend his atheism. And that has got weaker than it was back then. So as far as I'm concerned, as a biologist, has Darwin made atheism credible? Well, no, I'm afraid he hasn't, despite Richard Dawkins' claims to the contrary. And let me leave you with just one final image that I think sums up where this argument's at. Imagine that after this talk, you stepped outside for a stroll in the evening, for your one a day exercise during the lockdown, and someone met you and they handed you a brown envelope stuffed with cash, and you could see there must be several million pounds in there. And they said to you, you've won the lottery. And you said to them, well, what lottery? Well, you've won the lottery. And you say, well, what lottery is it that I've won? How do I know there is any lottery that I could have won? I haven't bought a lottery ticket. And they replied to you, well, if there weren't a lottery, this money wouldn't be here. And you said, is that your only argument for how you got this? And they said, yeah, the only way I can think of that this money could have got here is through a lottery, and the money is here. Therefore, there must have been such a lottery, and you are the lucky person who has won it. Well, that's really, I think, where atheists are when they're trying to explain to us where we came from. They say, you've won the lottery. And how do I know there was such a lottery in the first place? Well, we're here, so there must be. Whereas it's far more credible, I think, someone came up to you with a wad of cash and you said, where did it come from? And they said, well, somebody intended you to have this. And you say, well, how do I know that? And they say, well, here's their will. Before they died, they wrote the will and they said, my nephew, so-and-so, should be left £1 million. And you look into this will and you think, well, yeah, this looks very genuine. I've never heard of this relative before, but sounds very genuine to me. I'll accept this money because I have a very good idea of how it got here. And I think it's very much the same for us as we're thinking about how we got here. Far more plausible that somebody intended us to be here. And as a Christian, I've come to the conclusion that the place where we can find out more about this is in the Bible. This is like the will in my analogy. It tells us about the person who got us here and what he wants for us and why he's given us our lives in this amazing world that we live in the first place.
Richard, thank you very much indeed. Stimulating at every level. We're going to jump straight into our second phase of questions. And because we're on our backup tech here, we need to think that just about works. Guys, give me a thumbs up if that's looking okay. Using this microphone here. We've got lots of questions coming in. And if you're still thinking about the right question, can I encourage you to go onto Slido, hashtag Darwin is our event. And you'll see a number of questions there. You can vote on the ones that you would like me to ask. They go naturally to the top of the list. And so I will work from the list, which is very much being guided by your questions. So thank you very much. Thank you for being prepared to answer questions. How long have we got? We've got a good 20 minutes or so. So we'll dive straight in. What about people who... just changed as I was asking it. Here we go. We'll go for this one. I'll go for the top of the list. Thank you very much for voting for this. Can you believe in evolution and be a Christian?
Well, absolutely. The question to ask there is, well, what do you mean by evolution, of course? If by evolution you mean that everything has come about by an unguided natural process that did not have us in mind, then that does directly, of course, conflict with Christian teaching, which says God did have us in mind. And so if that's what you mean by evolution, then there's a conflict. But in the people who I mix with most of the time, evolution simply means change over time. And of course, you know, everyone believes in change over time. And if you want to be more precise, change in allele frequencies in populations over time, that's changes in how common or rare different genetic variants are in populations over time. And you can't deny that that's happening, and there's no conflict between that and the Christian faith. It's if you're trying to read into that word evolution extra philosophical claims about that basically imply atheism, then there's a conflict.
Well, let's stay on those sort of changes over time. What about people, the next question is, what about people that argue we evolved from apes?
Well, that doesn't have any bearing at all on the argument I've just made for theism. So what I've been saying is, even granted the Darwinian mechanism, there is still plenty of reason to think that there must have been an intelligence who is directing and who has a purpose and who is creative in the origins of this world. Now, we could talk a long time about exactly what the limits of evolution are, what can be explained by evolution, where we have to invoke the action of this intelligence. We can even talk about how God works. You know, does he work by big miraculous events, or does he work by just gradually steering the process? There's a whole load of other issues there, but the main point I'm making, that Darwin hasn't made it possible to be an intellectually fulfilled atheist in terms of allowing us to get away from huge, huge invocations of luck to explain how we got here. You know, that's a separate issue.
This one has risen to the top rapidly as you were speaking then. How do we explain the age of the earth and reconcile this with what the Bible says? How can we trust the Bible? Let's deal with those two questions separately. Do you want to just say a few things? A lot of people are interested in this. How do we explain the age of the earth and reconcile this with what the Bible says? Yeah. Now, I know this is a huge question. We touched on this beforehand when we were having a chat. Just a few sort of headlines, because we can't give a full answer at this level.
Yeah, well, obviously I'm a biologist and not a biblical scholar, so I'm sure Chris is better for telling you exactly what the Bible means. But as far as I can see, the Bible doesn't make any direct claims about how old the earth is. You know, there is no verse of the Bible that says the earth is X number of years old. And among Christians, Genesis chapter 1 is read in a whole variety of different ways. And only one of those ways says that the earth can only be a few thousand years old. So I think the Bible simply doesn't make the claim about the age of the earth.
I think there's a lot more that could be said. If that's a particular question that you have, then as Richard said, I mean, in one sense, if you're asking what the Bible says, it is a theological question. We'd love to follow that up with you, but I won't go into lots more details here. The follow-up question to that, though, was how can we trust the Bible? Now, I guess that's related to the first question in terms of the age of the earth, but just a few questions. I mean, you've come to the conclusion as a Christian that we can trust the Bible. Do you want to just say a few of the steps that you took to be able to make that step?
Yeah, so I think a very persuasive case can be made from our knowledge of the natural world without any reference to the Bible for the existence of God as a creative super intelligence. I think even without the Bible, I can be pretty sure, indeed certain, God. And then becomes, well, has this God tried to communicate with us? You know, if God has taken the trouble to make something as complex as the world we see around us and something as sentient as ourselves, beings that are relational, you know, we transcend pure matter in so many ways, in the way we think and we feel, in our moral values. There's something very, very peculiar about human beings. And we have to think, well, if there is a God and he made beings like us who are so relational, surely he would have, it's natural to think he would want to relate to us himself. It's not silly to think maybe he has tried to communicate with us himself. And of course, as we look around us, there are lots of claims for God's communication with us. And I think it's up to us then to examine those different claims and say which one of these seems to me to be the most credible claim to communication from God. And as I consider that question, the Bible comes out at the very top, because there are so many aspects of the Bible that just strike me as something that you wouldn't just make up. This isn't a book that humans would have invented. You know, there are things in it, you know, like the idea that God is Father, Son, and Holy Spirit. It's completely mind-blowing. And if you were trying to make up a religion, you wouldn't make up the Trinity. But if you were God who was beyond our thoughts, beyond our understanding, who was communicating with us, then we would expect to come across things which are very hard to understand, but yet at the same time very compelling and open up to us the idea of a God who can relate to us, who cares for us, who is involved with us. And to my mind, that, you know, what the Bible is telling us just strikes me as a bona fide, authentic revelation from God.
Let me just underline that. Again, speaking from a non-scientific point of view, it is a question that we get here in the city frequently, as I'm sure you can imagine. How can we trust the Bible? And the answer we give is exactly the same one that Richard gave just then. We need to sort of go to the Bible and see what it says. Don't take my word for it. Don't take Richard's word for it. I mean, go and make up your own mind. If this is God's revelation to us, then we better start with that revelation and see what you make of that. The Christianity Explore course that we're going to mention at the end, in about 10 minutes time or so, 15 minutes time, we'll give more details of what it looks like just to dip into a bit of the Bible, which may be of interest. So we'll come back to that. There are a lot of questions on Christianity beginning to come up, and a few more still that are getting to the top on some of the things you've been speaking about. So let's again stick on that for a little bit, and then we'll jump to some of the more of the questions on Christianity. How do you respond to the God of the gaps criticism, the belief that gaps in scientific knowledge are taken to be evidence or proof of God's existence?
Well, the account which Richard Dawkins gave to us didn't really have gaps, because where there was something that the Darwinian mechanism couldn't explain, he said, well, there must have been luck involved here. That's the best explanation he can give us. I guess you could say, well, Richard Dawkins has luck of the gaps and I have God of the gaps. If that's how you see it, then I would rather have a God of the gaps than luck of the gaps. But I think this idea that to argue for God is simply to argue for God of the gaps really makes mistakes about the history of science and what the scientific process is doing, because it suggests that science is always in the business of filling up gaps, and that as science progresses, the gaps just get smaller and smaller. And that's true of certain kinds of gap. You know, for example, I can't tell you every step from an acorn to an oak tree, but I'm sure that all of those steps will one day be fully understood by science. But there are other areas, like the origin of life, for instance, where the gap just gets bigger and bigger and bigger. The scientific progress isn't making that gap smaller, it's making it bigger. For example, in 1815, it wasn't until 1859, the same year as Darwin published The Origin of Species, that people finally stopped believing in spontaneous generation, the idea that life could spontaneously generate, for example, in a loaf as it went moldy. So before 1859, the origin of life seemed to be a commonplace, straightforward thing. Today, we understand much more about the molecular structures underlying life. The origin of life seems a bigger problem than it's ever been before. So if a gap is getting bigger and bigger, then it doesn't seem to me such an undesirable place for God to be.
What do you say to people that would suggest atheists are more intelligent than Christians, and that Christianity is just a bit of a fairy tale for the gullible?
I know some very intelligent atheists and some less intelligent atheists, and I can say the same of Christians. I think really this isn't about intelligence, it's just about rational thinking. None of these questions purely come down. All have bias and preconceptions, and none of us can fully think straight, I don't think. Whether we're an atheist or a Christian, you might be very intelligent, but hugely prejudiced against the idea of God, because there's something that you've perhaps done or you do in your life that you know that no theist would think was permissible, but yet you need to do that. And so even if I gave you the most compelling and intellectual case for God that was imaginable, that was entirely convincing, yet still your prejudice against the moral implications of theism could mean that you simply would not accept it. And so I think these things don't simply come down to intellect.
Just a brief word, can the Bible and Darwin both be right?
Yeah, absolutely.
Right.
That, you know, the Darwinian mechanism of random mutation and natural selection, I don't think is in itself in conflict with the Bible. Of course, sweeping conclusions drawn from it, like those we see in the God delusion, are not compatible with the Bible.
That's really helpful. If I came to believe that God did make the world and us, what difference should that make to me? Let me repeat that again. If I came to believe that God did make the world and us, what difference should that make to me? And actually, the next question, very close thing, why are you Richard Bugs a Christian? So rather than theoretically answering it for somebody else, what difference does it make to you? That sort of answers both of those.
Well, I think if we come to believe in God for the first time, then I think we should want to get to know God, or at least explore the possibility that we could get to know God, that he isn't just a distant deity who is stepped back from the universe he's created and doesn't care about what's going on. But we should strenuously explore the possibility that he could be communicating with us. And if that means you go away and you read a whole load of sacred texts from different religions and try and sort out which one of them you think is most authentic, I think that would be a very respectable thing to do. If you wanted to talk more with someone like Chris, who is very convinced that he knows that God is speaking to him in a particular place, then that would be a great thing to do as well. But I think you'd definitely want to try and explore things further and not just rest satisfied in a sort of vague belief in God who you don't know much about. Try and get to know him.
Let me just push you on that a little bit, because I think this is just such an interesting area. And again, an area that we often speak about here in the city as people want to investigate Christianity. I mean, actually sort of investigating, getting to know God. It makes sense. It sounds quite scientific. We've spoken already about the importance of going to the primary source, going to God's revelation. But as we do that, just tell us, I mean, obviously we meet Jesus Christ. What is it? What does that mean to sort of meet Jesus Christ on the pages of the book? Can you just describe what that was like for you? What that meant to you? I mean, you've got all your sort of science background and you meet a character in history. Yeah.
Well, when I read an account, for example, the gospel accounts of the trial of Jesus, I just find it a most amazing text. The sheer injustice of what is going on and the way Jesus doesn't get angry. You know, he's not had a night's sleep. And, you know, if I don't have a night's sleep, I get angry at the slightest thing. He doesn't have a night's sleep. And then he's got people punching him for no reason. He's got people contradicting him, people bringing false accusations. And just the way he deals with all that, I just find it awe-inspiring. And I was very disappointed. I listened recently to a podcast where Richard Dawkins was interviewed by Jeremy Paxman. It's on Apple Podcasts, quite a recent one. And Richard Dawkins said himself, you know, I feel moved by music about the passion, but I believe the passion is fiction. It's the same way as me getting moved by Romeo and Juliet. And I just find that so regrettable that he thinks this is fiction, because there seems to me a vast amount of historical evidence this really did happen. Jesus really did exist. We have multiple historical sources outside of the Bible that confirm that, and that he died by people who would have every reason not to be saying that. And so it seems to me that any rational person would look at these historical sources and think, this really happened. And the reason why I find it so moving is because there's someone incredibly special here who is acting in a way that no human being I know would act. But yet the way he's acting is so admirable and so compelling and so superhuman. And So to come back to your question, when what do we mean by meeting Jesus in the Bible? It's reading passages like that and just thinking, this is just such an awe-inspiring, amazing, wonderful person. And if he's still alive today, and I'm able to have a relationship with him, then that and spend eternity with him, then that is the most desirable thing I can imagine.
And just for the sake of clarity, let me push you on some of the details you referenced just then. You said this really happened, talking about the passion,
yeah.
The thing that Professor Richard Dawkins denies. There aren't many people, I think, that deny the existence of Jesus today and the death of Jesus today. Why, you know, what difference does that make to you?
Well, ultimately, I think all of us realize that we're very imperfect people. All of us regret things that we have done, and all of us regret things that we do. All of us regret habits that we have, things that we say we're never going to do again, but then we do again. You know, all of us have a problem with guilt. And what the Bible is telling me about the passion of Jesus is that this is a way in which my guilt can be dealt with, because Jesus comes as a sacrifice. The guilt of the world is laid on him, and he dies and carries the punishment for us and in our place. And so on the one hand, we see that God is taking our guilt seriously, and God isn't just saying, oh, it doesn't matter, that's okay. Because I think all of us would find that very unsatisfactory, both for ourselves and for wrong things we see other people do perhaps to us. You know, God isn't just saying this doesn't matter. But on the other hand, he's saying here's a way in which justice can be satisfied, but also forgiveness can be given. And it's that message of both having justice and forgiveness that I find so compelling, because so often in the world around us, we see either a complete lack of justice and people get away with things, or someone is condemned by public opinion and there's just no forgiveness for them. You know, there are certain individuals that just become the objects of universal condemnation with no possibility of forgiveness. And so both of these things, taking bad things seriously, but also having a way of forgiveness, that's what the cross does for us.
Thank you so much for explaining that. I just think it gets right to the heart. It's fascinating. I wasn't aware of that interview that you said Paxman had with Richard Dawkins. I mean, what a tragedy to not see the personal relevance of that event. So
yeah,
thank you. Thank you for explaining that for us. Look, we're ending at 10 past, so we've got about 6 minutes. We'll need two or three to close. So let's just do a few slightly quicker ones, if that's okay. There's a few here that all have sort of equal weight on dinosaurs and things. Maybe we won't go to that one. If nature proves that God exists, why don't more scientists believe in God? Just a quick answer to that, if that's possible.
I find that the more familiar you are sometimes with things, the more hardened you get to them. I remember a point as an undergraduate when I'd been to so many lectures about molecular biology. I'd got so used to seeing the complex structures of biology in front of me and learning about them that the wonder of it was beginning to sort of wear off. And I think that's probably happened with many biologists. We get so, you know, familiarity breeds contempt, and we just get so used to it, we just think, well, this is how it is. And so often, even in biology, we, behind the scenes, we're thinking, we're treating what we study as if it was a designed system. We're thinking, how would it work best? And we're formulating our hypotheses according to how we think a mechanism would work best. Because we know from experience that quite often, almost all the time, the way things do work in the natural world, in biological molecular mechanisms, is often the best way. But we end up not seeing the wood for the trees.
Thank you. Richard, look, let's end with this question. It is at the top of the pile, so it's a good one to end with. If I want to look into Christianity more, where do I begin? the Bible is so big, I'm not sure how to make sense of it.
I would say either start at the beginning or at the beginning of the New Testament and read through. And it is a difficult document. You know, it's an old document. There are things that are hard to understand. If you have a Christian friend who you could talk about it with, who could help you with that, then that would be great. You know, maybe meet up with them on Zoom or something and just talk through what you're reading, ask them to explain to you the harder things. Or else, if you don't have a Christian friend, I'm sure Chris would be glad to hear from you and line you up with someone who can help you understand more. Do you run courses as well, Chris?
Yeah, in fact, I'm going to introduce Tom in just a moment. He's going to tell us a little bit more about one of the courses. But look, why don't we close there, Richard? That's a really helpful series of answers. Thank you very much indeed for joining us. If we had a whole lot of people here, we'd probably give you a round of applause, but we don't, because everyone's on the camera. I'm sure they would if they could. Thank you very much indeed. Go and grab a seat over there. We won't do that in the current climate, will we? But thank you. Let me just say, we're going to talk a little bit more about one of the ways to take this further. And to do that, one of my colleagues here at St. Nick's Cole Abbey is Tom Bernardo. I'm going to hand over to him, who'll explain a little bit more about Christianity Explored.
Wonderful. Thanks, Chris. Christianity Explored is a three-week course introducing people to the key claims of the Christian faith. At St. Nick's, we run the course online across some Monday evenings. Our next course starts next Monday, the 23rd of November. Now, it won't surprise you to hear me say this because I've run the course, but I cannot recommend it highly enough. It's ideal if you're completely new to the Christian faith and you just want to ask big questions about God and Jesus and why Jesus came. It's great, too, if you are a Christian, but you just want to kind of brush up on the basics or bring along a friend. The evenings are informal and conversational and fun. We focus in on just a few sentences in Mark's gospel each week. As I say, our next course begins next Monday, 23rd of November, from 6 p.m. even to 7 p.m. on Zoom. And an email is going to hit your inbox shortly, giving you details about how you could sign up. Hope to see many of you then.